requirements where you could construct a kind of environment, right? So using certain kind of programming languages, you could build a house, right? And you could build things in the house. And these things in the house would have certain qualities that were interactive. It was all text-based, all completely text-based. So Second Life is probably the closest descendant to those things. So we started reading the literature and online communities in the late 90s. They all talked about HUDs and MOOCs and what went on in these spaces. And one of the most influential essays to come out of that time was actually in The Village Voice. It was written by a guy named Julian Dibble. It was called A Rape in Cyberspace. And it was about an incident that happened in a fairly well-known MOOC called Lambda MOOC. And in this incident, someone was able to manipulate other people's characters and make them do terrible things. And so Dibble's point in this article was, you know, how did this database, as he put it, go from being a database to being a community? And his rationale was, well, it became a community when it got laws. So these were the two major biases in early writings about online communities. There had to be a sense of place. There was a place you went and you did stuff, and it had a kind of virtual physicality to it. And it was governed by laws. It was governed by rules. So circa 2001, when I started getting interested in this material, nobody did MUDs and MOOCs anymore. They were gone, right? When I taught a class at the University of Virginia with like 100 students in it, there was one student in that class who had ever been in a MOOC, right? So what was everybody doing? They were doing instant messenger, they were doing email, they were doing, you know, various, you know, pre-Facebook kinds of social networking sites. And I thought, well, this is really interesting. I mean, why isn't this community? You know, why is what these people are doing, which is ad hoc, which is all based on a kind of, you know, random interactions with other people or choosing kinds of interactions to have, why isn't this considered community? So at that time, while I was thinking about this, I started reading more stuff in cybernetics and systems theory. And specifically, I was interested in the work of Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, who are sort of setting-over cyberneticists, and a kind of obscure German media critic named Wilhelm Flusser. And Flusser, and also, I would say, Hakim Bey's The Temporary Autonomous Zone. So these are the three things that I had read going into thinking about this that got me thinking about other ways of formulating or theorizing online social formations. Excuse me. I'm getting over a cold, so... So what I was interested in, particularly, was the way in which, you know, these kind of biases towards defining online community kind of all implicitly or explicitly adopted this Habermasian model of consensus, right? This is what makes a community. So we all come together and we all agree on what we're supposed to do. Well, this naturally rankled the anarchist in me. And I started wanting to think about, well, is there a way to think about community, I think sort of Tocoon-like, that doesn't involve consensus? Is there other ways to formulate this idea? So what interested me in Bay, which came out in 1995, so very early in the advent of the internet, and he begins talking in there about kind of ad hoc systems of exchange that can be built through what he calls the web. So he sees there being the net, which is the formal, official, connective communications device, and the web, which is something that is developed sort of through the underground of the internet. And I really liked his idea of the model of the temporary autonomous stuff and how that could be applied to the internet as it existed in the early 2000s. So he was about 5 years behind in time, as far as I was concerned. Wilhelm Flusser wrote an essay also around the same time called The City as Wave Trough in the Image Flood, which is now available in translation. I originally read it in German, and it confounded me at first when I read it, because he kept wanting to refer to the city as being not a physical space, but as a place in which subjectivities become knotted together. And he has this concept of the subject that is essentially empty, aside from biologic interaction. So the only way subjectivity arises is in through interaction with others. Otherwise, it's just an empty thing. And I thought that was very interesting, this idea that subjects are knots. And this is something that would become important much later. And then Maturana and Varela have this idea that's very similar of the notion that community is really about communication. It has nothing to do with physical space. It has to do with interaction among individuals. So I took these three things and I decided to apply that to the idea of online communities. And this was the beginning of my interest in nodes. And that's kind of what I'm working on now. My interest was in the idea of the subject as a node, and that subject has a kind of multiplicity to it depending on what kinds of other nodes it connects to. So in that model of the subject, as I said, is a kind of multiplicity. What arises depends on what you come into relationship with, right? And so any individual subject can have multiplicities. The other interesting thing about this for me was it was a way of getting at a very disembodied idea of the subject. So in the virtual world, the online world, your subjectivity is represented almost purely by text or by avatars that you create, right? So there's all kinds of ways to then configure what your subjectivity is or could be or what you imagine it to be, right? So you're not stuck in the body. So that was all the stuff I was working in circa around 2000. And then I dropped out of the academic world for a long time and sold my soul to the technology industry for a while. And what I became very interested in, having come up with this idea of kind of like the nodal subject, as I started working in the technology industry, I noticed that nodes were everywhere. Everything is about nodes. Particularly if you look at the early work on theorizing how the internet would work, Paul Moran's work. It's a diagram of nodes. If you start looking into what's behind Facebook and LinkedIn and most social networking applications these days, they're graph databases. And a graph database is built upon nodes. I thought, where are all these nodes coming from? What's going on here? And then I started to notice that throughout, in very contemporary critical theory, nodes are everywhere. Everyone talks about X is like a node in a network. You can find it in Foucault. You can find it in a lot of contemporary media theory, all this stuff around nodes. So what I've been thinking about, and what I think kind of ties into the cybernetic hypothesis here, is the prevalence of the discourse of the node as it has manifested in contemporary culture. Something that was not present, I think, 10 years ago, and which, interestingly, as we've been talking about, I think ties in very in an interesting way to these problems of social organization, but also and resistance to power, because nodal networks can come up and disappear as quickly as you want them to. On the other hand, the way in which the concept of the node and the interlocked system has become part of globalization, right? So there's this kind of double edge to it. And that's what I started working on. So what I want to talk about a little bit today, so I have a lot of questions around the kind of stuff we've been talking about. I don't have any settled ideas on this yet. And I find myself, I woke up actually on February 10th of last year and heard someone on NPR's Marketplace say, capitalism is an integrated system. And that's why I went, oh, hey, maybe all this stuff I've been thinking about is kind of going down the wrong track. So I'm kind of in this position, I think, like many of us here, where on the one hand, I want to see the potential for alternative political formations and social formations within this idea of nodalism. But on the other hand, I also see how it's very quickly and easily co-opted towards other areas. So I thought one of the things I would do is present a little bit of an alternative genealogy to what's presented in here. Because as I said at the outset, I think there are certain aspects of cybernetics, especially in its later stages, that is not concerned with homeostasis, is not concerned with equilibrium, but rather is concerned with emergence and unpredictable behavior in a way that is not really brought out in here. So, do we have a marker? Mm-hmm. Can I use that, please?
Yeah, sure.
And as I said, I think there's stuff in this genealogy that I think can go in two directions.
Could you say really briefly just what exactly you mean by a node?
A node?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of familiar, I guess, with the philosophical idea, but more technical in computer science language.
Well, actually, the thing is, in computer science, it's interesting because this is kind of a genealogy. So there are a number of strands that converge in this figure, right? So is there an eraser?
Oh, I think that stuff is
permanent.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So it is.
This is a donated.
Okay. Well, I'll be writing over algebraic equations.
Yeah.
Okay. So originally, the term node has to do with a knot, and it refers to like knots in wood, right? If you go back to the 16th century, when you see the first appearance of this word in English, it has to do with organic formations. So a node can be like a knot in wood. It can be an outcropping of rock. It's a contained thing that somehow bulges out, right? And there's no indication that it has a connection to other nodes. It's a singularity at this point, right? So the real important moment, I think, in the history of the node is 1891, with the discovery of the neuron. This is the thing that I think sets a lot of this stuff in motion. You'll notice that in the presentation that that John did. A lot of cyberneticists were also neuroscientists. There's a very strong connection between neuroscience and cybernetics. In 1891, the neuron is first described and drawn. And so people begin seeing, I'm going to do a very schematic version of it, but they begin to see that there are these structures in the brain, that look kind of like this. We're going to draw kind of a schematic of it, right? So there's all these objects that are connected to other objects, and there's all kinds of speculation that begins about how does this work? What's going on? What's the nature of these things? What's the nature of the connection between them? What happens when they interact with each other? So, 1891, you have the neuron discovered. The first use of the term node in the sense that I'm looking at it is in Freud, in The Interpretation of Dreams, which is 1900. Now, remember that prior to this, so between here and here, in 1895, is the project for a scientific psychology, which is a weird little book. It doesn't come out until much later, but it's the one in which Freud is attempting to figure out, well, how do these things work? What's the relationship of the functioning of the neuron to various energies, right? Everything is formulated in terms of energies at this point. So 1900, it comes out with The Interpretation of Dreams. Right, and in the section on the dream work, he has this very strange line where he says, he's trying to figure out, how to dream, what's the nature of the dream? And he's talking about the dream of the mechanic monograph. And in this dream, there are these two words or these two images, botanic and monograph. And he sees these two terms having all these associations that kind of go off to other things. And he specifically uses the term node to describe these two terms. That these are nodes that send off associations to other thoughts. And so what I think Freud is doing here in the interpretation of dreams is he's taking this model that's coming out of neuroscience, and he says, okay, there are these things, these individual little things, each of which is a thought or an idea. And when I have a dream, you know, this is being triggered, and it's leading off to other associations. And so these become the primary nodal points. Now, what's interesting about this, you know, this might seem kind of random in general, but prior to the discovery of the neuron, there is a branch of philosophy called associationism. Associationism comes out of the late 18th century, and it's an attempt to come up with a model of mind. And specifically, you know, how do you go from one thought to the next thought? So at this point, what happens when the neuron is discovered is that associationism finally finds a kind of material support for this concept of how mind functions. So this kind of associational model of thought based upon the discovery of the neuron plays out in a number of ways. It plays out very interestingly, though, through the world of information technology. So 1900, interpretation of dreams, Freud is trying to come up with this model of thought, associational model of thought based on neuronal structures. 1943 through 45, Vannevar Bush comes out with an essay called As We May Think. And in this essay, which came out in the Atlantic Monthly in 1945, it's toward the end of World War II. Vannevar Bush has been involved with the Office of Technological Research for the war at MIT. And he comes up with this model for something that he calls the MIMEX. And the MIMEX is a device. The MIMEX is kind of like a desk, right? And in this desk, you have the ability to call things up on microfilm and examine them, and make links, make physical links between that item and other items. It's an early attempt to come up with hypertext, right? The idea is, I'm a researcher, and I need some way to control the vast amounts of information that are available to me. I need some way to build relationships between things that I'm researching. And I don't necessarily want to do it in outline form or typical form. I want to do it in a way that replicates the actual process of thought. So what's interesting about this moment is we have a model of thought that's over here that's based on this idea of discrete items being linked together in an associational way that is then attempting to be instantiated in an actual physical technological device. So this is kind of an important moment. This MIMEX device is never built, right? This is entirely theoretical. But this serves as the basis or the inspiration for later developers of hypertext, such as Tim Berners-Lee, Ted Nelson, who was one of the first developers of hypertext. These guys really get caught up in this idea of associational thought and replicating this through technological devices. And there's a kind of discursive bias here, the idea that things must be brought into association with one another to have meaning. Right? Isolated data bits mean nothing. They only mean something when you bring them into association with something else. So this discursive bias, I think, is something that's very predominant today. One of the things that I worked on when I was in the technology industry, I worked for a company that was developing a graph database called Freebase, unfortunately. Let me tell you the marketing discussions that went on around that. And the idea was, we're going to build this database that... So, let me back up. So, you have... Is there an eraser?
That's a good question.
So, going back to your original question. So, there's sort of a set of convergences here, right? There is the neuron as a node, figured as a node. So, that's neuroscience. There is this idea of replicating thought through technological devices, which means bringing discrete things into association with each other, which is what gives them meaning. The other somewhat obscure side of this
is what's called graph theory, which comes out of mathematics.
And in graph theory, the famous example in graph theory, or the origination of graph theory, comes in the late 18th century, again, with this, with a kind of topographical or topological problem called the Seven Bridges of Leiden. And the problem was there a way that you could walk all seven bridges in this city without recrossing your same path, right? So this becomes the origin of the topographical study of graphs. And in graph theory, you have nodes, which are vertices, and you have the connectors between them, which are called edges. So what's really interesting about contemporary information technology, especially the internet, think about that word, the internet, right, is really the convergence of three different lines of thought. One is this idea of, okay, we want to find some way to model the process of thought. We want to find some way to model mind, right? So there's the model of mind. And then there's this graph theory stuff. And the graph theory stuff... the important figure here is Paul Barrand. And this is one of the places where the cybernetic hypothesis kind of goes off the track. Paul Barrand, in 1960, was working for RAND, the RAND Corporation. And on his own, he kind of took up this problem of the survivability of communications networks in the case of attack. And so in this paper, he does these various diagrams of different kinds of communications networks. There's the centralized one, right, with a point in the middle and everything going out in the radius, right? Obviously, easily destroyed in the case of attack. Then there's a decentralized one, which, it's basically points with rays going off from them, right? And again, you just get the right guy, everything's done. The third model he comes up with is a distributed communications network, which looks remarkably like the structure of all these little neurons. Right, once again. Right? So we now have communication systems. Right? So between these two things, what I find interesting in the history of the internet and its development is there's a point where these two things are seen as converging, right? If you want to really create an effective system of thought, it's about building communications between things. So the important figure out of this, who kind of brings all this stuff together, is J.C.R. Linklater, who is the guy responsible for the development of ARPANET, which is what the internet turns into. Now, this is, as I said, in the cybernetic hypothesis, they bring up the idea that the ARPANET was developed out of this idea of a survivable communications network. That is not the case. What's interesting about J.C.R. Licklider was, although he is not a cyberneticist per se, he's very interested in these associational models of thought. And he's interested in the way in which you can develop you can develop communications networks that would facilitate interaction. So he takes as his model, so as the one of the developers behind ARPANET, ARPANET's whole idea was to connect various research facilities across the United States. So Lincoln Lab, MIT, Stanford, I forget what the fourth one was. Four institutions doing U.S. government research had nothing to do with missiles, had nothing to do with any of that kind of stuff, right? It's the idea that we have these four institutions doing government research, and wouldn't it be nice if we could get all the people who were at these different institutions, wouldn't it be good if we could get some way for them to talk to each other? You know, what's the best way to really facilitate collaborative work? Right, we need some kind of communication system that will enable that. And we need something that will enable the people over here to have access to the materials people over here are working with. Right? So for Licklider, he was very interested in this idea of collaborative work. Right? And what I think is really interesting is he starts from this premise that the only good work that is done in collaboration with others. So, let me read you this little quote. In 1963, Licklider co-authored a paper with Robert Taylor, who was a former neuroscientist, called The Computer as Communication Device. So this is one of the seminal papers in the history of the internet. And he comes up with this particular model of thought based on the project meeting. For him, the seminar, the project meeting, is the ideal model of how thought works. So each individual in a project meeting is a node, is a discrete unit. And the goal is to bring these discrete units together to create something. So they say, any communication between people about the same thing is a common revelatory experience about informational models of that thing. Each model is a conceptual structure of abstractions formulated initially in the mind of one of the persons who would communicate. And if the concepts in the mind of one would-be communicator are very different from those in the mind of another, there is no common model and no communication. That's a pretty interesting description of what goes on between individuals. Everything has to come down to commonality. And what's really interesting to me about this, especially in the discussion of being disconnected and disappearance, in not being visible, is Licklider and Taylor really distrust the individual. They say, by far the most numerous, most sophisticated, and most important models are those that reside in men's heads. In richness, plasticity, facility, and economy, the mental model has no peer, but in other respects, it has shortcomings. It will not stand still for careful study. It cannot be made to repeat a run. No one knows just how it works. It serves its owner's hopes more faithfully than it serves reason. It has access only to the information stored in one man's head. It can be observed and manipulated only by one person. Now here's the killer line. Society rightly distrusts the modeling done by a single mind. Well, I think that'd be a big surprise to generations of romantics. Society demands consensus, agreement, at least majority. Fundamentally, this amounts to the requirement that individual models be compared and brought into some degree of accord. The requirement is for communication, which we now define concisely as cooperative modeling. Cooperation in the construction, maintenance, and use of a model. So, this, I think, is very interesting because it is a bit of a genealogy of how the internet, as we know it, came into being. It came into being in order to facilitate cooperative modeling. The origin of the ARPANET was to create a space in which this kind of project meeting, consensus building, cooperative modeling could take place. So I think it's interesting to think about there's a kind of bias built into the internet that is built around these associational ideas. One must associate. One must come into contact with others. One must be part of a community. And if you're not, we distrust you. Right? We rightly distrust the modeling done by a single mind. I think that's a very interesting idea. So this is kind of the problem that I've been dealing with and why I think the cybernetic hypothesis is an interesting text. On the one hand, this idea of the node, I think, has this potential to open up the possibility of this kind of ad hoc, multiple subjectivity kinds of experiences for individuals. And it can be used, I think, for certain interesting kinds of political organization. On the other hand, and this is where I think some of the points that the essay raises are really interesting, it forces us, you know, it has this kind of associative bias built into it. And so what I think is the way that you kind of split the difference on this, or at least the way that I've been thinking about splitting the difference on this, we've talked a lot about the problem around system and the system being sort of total and regulated. That, I would say, is the Licklider view of how nodes and networks work, right? You bring everything into contact with everything else. You have a kind of total system. Everything leads towards consensus, right? And eventually you hit a kind of equilibrium, right? There's an equal standing between the nodes after they have engaged in this process of cooperative modeling. In some sense, the nodes are all the same, right? In that system. The whole point is that everybody comes to agreement. Everybody is kind of undifferentiated in a way. On the other hand, what I think is interesting about the later work of people like Maturana and Varela and Willem Flissert is that it doesn't aim towards consensus at all. Right? It aims towards emergent behaviors. And emergence can't be predicted. It can't be regulated. And it has no truck with consensus. Right? It's about whatever happens. And so this is kind of the thing that I've been struggling with in thinking about these things. And, you know, looking back upon my prior work, is exactly, you know, where do these kind of associational models, where does this idea of nodes and networks take us? And can we, you know, just say that, you know, it's inherently evil and is going to lead us down the road towards a kind of regulated system in which everyone is, you know, part of the cooperative mass, or does it actually have some kind of liberating potential within it? So, unfortunately, this has not been a very good presentation, but this is kind of what I've been thinking about. And I think that, you know, if we start thinking about nodes, if we start thinking about what the status of the node is within these systems and how that node is theorized, I think that gets us into thinking about some of the questions that are raised by the cybernetic hypothesis. What's the nature of the subject within this network? Is the nature of the subject to be reduced to just another associational consensus being? Or is there a way in which participating in the network gives rise to things that aren't subject to regulation and control? So, questions, comments?